Talking about advertising your club's upcoming Ham Fest or Field Day participation, but something that is out of the ordinary. If so, send us a brief overview via the contact page at arnewsline.org. If it's newsworthy and we would like to cover it, we'll get back to you for more details.
This is Tommy Keene, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
Why did you say that? Aloha out there in Radio Land.
Hey, this is Andy, host of Crawl Up from the Fallout with Raven Sings the Blues. The show is a monthly roundup of new music, plumbing psych, folk, cosmic Americana, indie, garage, and exploratory titles, alongside enough classic gems to hold it all together like glue. You can tune into the show every second Tuesday of the month from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on WGXC 90.7 FM.
The Catskill Town Board meets every first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at the Catskill Town Hall and holds a committee meeting the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. You can turn out in person at the Catskill Town Hall to speak at these meetings or tune in to a live web stream through the Catskill Town Board and WGXC. Go to wgxc.org/listen or click on the listen button at wgxc.org to tune in to any of the Catskill Town Board meetings, the first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. and the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at wgxc.org and townofcatskillny.gov.
WGXC underwriting support has been provided by Dedicated Presentation Solutions. Allow DPS to turn your audiovisual how-do-eyes into here's-how-you-cans. Visit dedicatedpresentation.com or call 845-475-8465 for more information. Dedicated Presentation Solutions, your audiovisual partner.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of the Bridge Street Theater in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra, Catskill, Hudson, New York 90.7 FM. Listeners reported. It's radio for open ears, open heart, open hands, and open mind. We give thanks again to you for supporting WGXC all through the years, and then I hope that you stay with us.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. The Guardian has an interactive map of the United States showing where air pollution is worse. Locally, the area just east of the Hudson River throughout the Hudson Valley has the worst air quality. The Catskill and Albany areas also have worse air quality, and from Copec south along the border with Connecticut is another zone with lower air quality, according to the map based on information from the Center for Air, Climate, and Energy Solutions. The city of Hudson, for instance, has 6.6 micrograms of fine particulate matter per cubic meter on average from 2011 to 2015, according to the map. The World Health Organization considers 5 micrograms its safe level. See the map where you can plug in your zip code and find results on the Guardian website. Cornell Cooperative Extension is looking for volunteers to help with the Department of Environmental Conservation's annual eel count in streams and rivers from New York City to Albany County from late March through May. American eels are migratory fish that are hatched in the Atlantic Ocean and enter rivers as tiny glass eels each spring. The species is in decline over much of its range, and baseline studies are needed for conservation. Locally, the count takes place at Hanacroy Creek site in Baltimore. Anyone interested in helping should email or call Lindsay Strelew-Howey of CCE Columbia and Greene Counties at las549@cornell.edu and 518-622-9820 extension 112. To help at any other location, email or call Sarah Mount of NYSDEC at sarah.mount@dec.ny.gov or 845-889-4745 extension 106. Chad Arnold reports in the Daily Gazette that 2 years after recreational cannabis use became legal in New York and several months after retail stores were predicted to open throughout the state, only three have. There are two in New York City and one in Binghamton. The owners of the Upstate Canna Company dispensary in Connecticut say they will open their store March 31st. Meanwhile, a pending lawsuit has a judge temporarily blocking the opening of any cannabis stores in five regions of the state, including the Hudson Valley. Read the full story in the Daily Gazette. The Times Union reports that on March 9th, state officials requested to relocate a, and I quote, rare and significant, end quote, Columbia County building from New York's Turnpike area 30 feet to protect it from traffic and road hazards. Hillsdale's Columbia Turnpike East Toll House on the north side of Route 23 used to charge passersby on a turnpike between western Massachusetts and the Hudson River that was active between 1799 and 1906. The building was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 2016. The New York State Board of Historic Preservation has signed off on the move. And you can read the full story at the Times Union website. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Women, life, freedom, the power and promise of International Women's Day. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. March 8th, International Women's Day, arrived not a day too soon as women, half the world's human population, still endure varying degrees of oppression, violence, inequality, and discrimination. This day's living history is steeped in struggle and celebration, a day when women protest with courage and tenacity. From the Taliban to Texas, men wield words and weapons to subjugate women. Solidarity and action to protect and liberate women are needed now more than ever. Systemic oppression of women may be worse than Afghanistan. Richard Bennett, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Afghanistan, calls the Taliban's treatment of women
tantamount to gender apartheid.
In an update to the UN Human Rights Council on March 6th, Bennett said,
"The Taliban's intentional and calculated policy is to repudiate the human rights of women and girls and to erase them from public life. It may amount to the international crime of gender persecution, for which the authorities can be held accountable."
That same day, in a remarkably brave protest, Afghan women held a read-in sitting on the ground outside Kabul University. They opened books and began reading, defying the Taliban's ban on education for women and girls.
Those women that protested yesterday in Kabul, they know what they're facing. They know that when they go to streets and ask for their rights, it's gone. It's the killing. They might be killed on the streets.
That's Zahra Nader speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. She's an Afghan-Canadian journalist and editor-in-chief of Zan Times, a media outlet that covers human rights in Afghanistan.
They're still willing to take that risk because that is what's going to, you know, bring them hope. There's a fight for them to resist for their fights and what they want, even if that come at the cost of their own lives.
Next to Afghanistan and Iran, nationwide protests continue, sparked by the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in police custody last September 16th. Amini was arrested by Iran's so-called morality police, accused of not wearing her hijab properly. The Iranian government has responded to the protests with a harsh crackdown, arresting thousands. Four men have been publicly executed so far simply for protesting. 14 more face execution, according to Amnesty International. Now a wave of apparent poisonings has struck Iranian girls' schools. At least 290 schools have been targeted, affecting no less than 7,000 students.
These horrific chemical attacks on girls' schools that have swept the nation have to be understood as a punishment against women and girls who have been leading this nationwide revolt for several months now.
That's Manijeh Mehrdadian, professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at Barnard College on Democracy Now!
In response, people have been protesting. In fact, the National Teachers Union called for nationwide strikes, sit-ins, and demonstrations. And by my latest count, there have been such demonstrations in at least 17 cities. This is a nation in revolt.
March 8th is significant in modern Iranian history. The Iranian Revolution ousted the brutal U.S.-backed dictator, the Shah of Iran, in January 1979. Millions of Iranians hoped for a democratic, secular future. Instead, the return from exile of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini ushered in harsh theocratic rule. On March 8, 1979, Iranian women rose up in protest against the Ayatollah's new regime.
Those women who poured into the streets on International Women's Day 43 years ago, who rightly understood that the enforcement of mandatory Islamic dress code, mandatory hijab, was part and parcel of the erosion of all of the democratic promises of the revolution.
Professor Mehrdadian explained. She went on to link this history to today.
In Iranian Kurdistan, in Saqqez, the hometown of Mahsa Jina Amini, the teachers are on strike right now, defending the right of women and girls to education, but also condemning the broader state repression and the economic crisis that's really impoverishing ordinary people in Iran. Of course, Saqqez is where this uprising began in September with the slogan, Women, Life, Freedom, a slogan that is all about life and joy, echoing some of the themes earlier in your show that are connected, deeply connected to feminist movements and to International Women's Day.
Republican politicians in the United States decry the Taliban, including its treatment of women. But their apparent feminism only goes so far as these legislators pass law after law attempting to control women's bodies, restrict reproductive health care, and criminalize abortion. In Texas, five women have sued the state after they were unable to obtain an abortion to terminate life-threatening pregnancies. 4 months into her pregnancy, plaintiff Amanda Zorofsky's water broke. She needed an abortion but couldn't find a Texas doctor willing to do it. She then developed sepsis, which could have killed her. She may never be able to give birth again. The imprisonment of women for miscarrying, as happens already in El Salvador and other countries, may be coming soon to red states in the United States. March 8th, International Women's Day, began as a socialist protest among striking mill workers in Lawrence, Massachusetts, demanding not only bread, but roses. Now, over a century later, in addition to bread and roses, women, gender nonconforming, and trans and LGBTQ plus people are demanding education, bodily autonomy, equal pay, and freedom from violence. The struggle continues. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And now, here is your WGXC weather update. On Sunday, partly sunny with a high near 44 degrees. And Sunday night, a chance of snow after 1 a.m. It will be cloudy with a temperature low of around 32 degrees. And that is your weather update from WGXC. 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. In Greene and Columbia counties.
The Times Union a few weeks ago early February wrote a story about some of the conflict of interest that seemed to be evident in the town of Queemans in the southern part of Albany County along the river, Hudson River, between George McHugh, relatively recently elected as town supervisor, and his prior relationship with the owner of much of the town, particularly the Queemans port. Carver Larraway, who also runs the Carver Companies. And we did have Sarah Prusma on last week, and check our mediacentury.org website to talk about some of the things raised with George McHugh and the conflict of interest in the articles. But we're joined today by Ashley and Jason Redfield, who live along River Road, which by the name implies probably right along the river. And they've had some real concerns about what the Carver Company tends to be doing on some land, I guess, apparently right behind their property. So welcome, Ashley and Jason. Do you want to explain to people what's going on?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having us on.
Thank you for having us.
I guess like a couple of weeks ago, I mean, I work nights and I started hearing diesel engines in the daytime while I was trying to go to sleep. And at first I was saying to my wife, I don't know what that is. Like we thought it was just the port. And then all of a sudden there was logging equipment basically almost in our backyard. And I was like, well, as long as it stays over there, that's fine. And then it just came right up to our property line and all of the trees were gone. So I guess that's where we're at right now.
Yeah, basically 15 acres of forest were just torn down what seemed like overnight, and nobody bothered to reach out to us. Nobody told us what would be happening, what was going on, what the intended use for this property was to be. And still to this day, since I began first asking questions, I first started at town hall with a FOIL request and then put in a request with the DEC. Ultimately, they told me that it was just a general use permit, that they were allowed to do all of this, clear cutting with. And basically since then, I've just been asking questions. I've reached out to Carver. I've left emails, messages, nobody's returned any of my calls. Everybody at town hall just basically seems to act like nothing's happening here.
Or we've been kind of like stonewalled, I guess. There was a town thing.
Well, let me give you a little background to the listeners. So Port of Queemans is part of this $200 million grant State of New York did to develop offshore wind. Most is going to Port of Albany, some is to Port of Queemans. So just, reading articles, it seemed like, as you said, they've not really disclosed what they're going to do with this land. Some conjecture is might be where they'll dump the construction and demolition debris, from what their expansion they could do with the port, maybe something else to do. But knowing at City Hall, knowing at Town Hall, Carver not willing to provide answers.
Apparently last night at the town meeting, it was the first time that anything
that anybody actually
from Carver said like what their intended use of the land was gonna be. But I mean, if that was the case, why couldn't it have been said to us from the get-go? Like the whole idea of being a good neighbor is to everybody that bought a house in this area has bought a house under the idea that we've got this forest behind us. Uh-huh. And they basically ripped that away from us in the course of a day. And why wouldn't you just tell the residents what's going on? Like if it's going to be agricultural or residential or whatever, why wouldn't you just say I'm going to use this land for cows?
Yeah.
Just reach out.
And over the last week, they put up all these signs that say no trespassing, video surveillance, violators will be prosecuted. And it's if you're just, gonna clear out the trees and turn it into a farm, why not just say that? And why be so sneaky about it? And why now are you they're paying people to sit in a security vehicle and patrol. What are you hiding? You know, it just it I feel like the further we dig, the more questions we get. And that's what I'm confused about. And even if they say that it's just going to be agricultural residential use, I just don't know if I can believe that because the trust has already been violated.
And,
you know?
And it's on the riverfront. Right. So
I was going to ask you, maybe you could describe, you know, River Rose. I assume it's sort of close to the river. And, you know, I know in my town, I used to be on my town board, you know, the general rule, besides supposed to be good neighbors and town officials supposed to be good, you know, public officials, you know, sort of if you're applying to do something, especially like clearing land or building something, you're actually supposed to notify and write in the people who are adjacent to the property. So I assume none of that has occurred. And nothing. So at this point, they're saying they're not doing this part of the port expansion, but it's agriculture and residential construction, or are they clear what they're saying?
I mean, they're saying that this particular piece of land they're planning on using for residential / agriculture. But like I said, this is the first we've heard from it, and that was from last night's town board meeting. But I also know that the land next to it on the same road has been discussed as a potential spot for them to do stuff for their port expansion. So
yeah, it states in their report that 87 Bronc has been identified as a location where they're going to be dumping fill, presumably from the dredging. But we've also heard that there are materials that are at the port that they're going to need to relocate, and so that they can grade. And we don't know what's in those that fill, you know? And so we're just like wondering, are they going to try and secretly relocate something onto that property that could potentially contaminate our well water? Because everybody over here is on a well. And, you know, I just, even if they're maintaining right now that it's just going to be this like residential agricultural area, it just doesn't make sense for that to be the case.
And my recollection is particularly with, Carville Arroway is that, you know, he has pushed a number of proposals that have generated a lot of opposition in the community, burning tires at the Lafarge cement plant where they'd be imported at the port, and then also some type of ash landfill. And so they have been, you know, rejected, but then he has now basically invested more resources in order to take political control of the town. And it doesn't seem like, I don't know, democracy is the focal point right now of how government is operating in Queens. Would that be accurate?
I don't feel like residents are, if they're being heard, I don't think that they're being taken seriously.
We're certainly not considered. We're not a high priority. I feel like in this town, it's just the big businesses that matter. And the residents just don't matter. And it's very sad.
Now, we have only about a minute left. I understand there's a couple upcoming meetings where some of this is going to be discussed.
Yes. We're going to be hosting a couple of meetings on March 14th and the 18th. They're going to be at the RCS Community Library. And we're basically asking the anybody who's interested, anybody that this affects, to come down and to express their opinions on it. And I guess people from Carver Co. are going to be there, and who knows, maybe people from the town board. And I feel like if we could get the whole community together in one room and have a discussion about this,
dialogue.
Yeah, that maybe we can get some clear answers and we can express our frustrations and the way that this has been approached, you know.
So we've been talking with Ashley and Jason Redfield, River Road residents and town of Queemans. If people want more information about the situation, is there a website or anything?
Yes. There is Clean Air
Coalition.
AlbanyCounty.org.
Thank you very much. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Shimani Gibson, 30 years old, died 13 days after giving birth. Amber Rose Isaac, 26, died due to complications of an emergency C-section. Shasia Washington, 26, from undergoing a C-section. Denise Williams, 29, 58 hours after seeking postpartum care for a pulmonary embolism. This list is not exhaustive, but the truth is we know these names, and this is the fear with which we go through the birthing process, oftentimes as Black women. And what we need to remember is that in New York, 78% of maternal deaths in Black individuals were declared preventable. And we know that a crucial piece of combating this maternal mortality crisis is the role of doulas.
That was State Senator Samra Brook speaking on Tuesday, March 7th, at the New York State Senate Health Committee's hearing on a new proposal to integrate doulas into the state medical system and allow Medicaid to reimburse for doula services. Liz Adeo, a birth doula and part of the company Afterglow Albany Birth, explained what a doula does.
We've been giving birth from the dawn of man, and we used to have support. And it really was usually families, or we'd live in villages and we'd be able to support that process. But in our modern day, we really don't have access to that as much as we used to. And so doulas kind of fill the gap. And what they do is support the prenatal, the birth and labor, and the postpartum portion of the first birth year. The ways that we support are through education, information. We give physical support, emotional support through the birthing process. We help people with birth planning and figuring out what their intentions are for the birth. And then we attend the birth with them. And then postpartum, we do support as well and with breastfeeding and from hospital to home, that transition.
Her colleague, Saratoga doula Christine Hernandez, addressed the hearing.
The United States is facing a maternal and infant health crisis. Black and brown birthing people are dying of pregnancy and birth-related causes at a rate of, depending on who you ask, sometimes 3, 4, or 5 times higher than white birthers, according to the Centers for Disease Control. In the state of New York, approximately 31% of live births occur by cesarean section, despite the recommendation of 10 to 15% by the World Health Organization. That means 31% of people are sent home 2 to 3 days after having major abdominal surgery to care for a newborn when they aren't even supposed to be walking up a flight of stairs. In addition to the dangers to their physical health, birthing people are also facing a mental health crisis, which has only gotten worse post-COVID. After all the many visits a pregnant person has, after birth there is minimal follow-up care. Most postpartum visits with a care provider are not scheduled until 6 weeks after birth, leaving perinatal mood and anxiety disorders to go unnoticed and untreated. Doulas have long been filling in the gaps in care provided by our mental health care system. Doulas have the unique opportunity to work closely with birthing people and provide physical and emotional support during childbirth and postpartum. Studies have shown that doula support during childbirth lowers the risk of cesarean by up to 39%. And improves maternal health outcomes overall. Shorter labors, less unnecessary medical intervention, and higher APGAR scores for babies. Doulas encourage people to advocate for themselves, letting them know what their rights are as a patient in the hospital system. They also encourage agency and ownership of the birthing experience, helping to combat the discrimination and marginalization that some birthing people face in our medicalized maternal care system. They provide reassurance and emotional security, especially in marginalized communities where people feel disempowered or uncomfortable with their care providers. They help facilitate connection to community resources and develop a relationship with the birthing person that continues long after the postpartum period, leading to a greater sense of connectedness and safety. Having pregnancy support that comes from within people's own communities fosters trust and eases anxiety. Currently, there are many barriers to accessing doula services, and they exist and range from the lack of availability of doulas to financial constraints.
Ms. Adeo explained how the proposed program could work.
So insurance companies are starting to understand the value of our services and how we can apply that through their benefits. Right now, for example, in the Capital District, there's a private insurance CDPHP, and they have a new program that started in January where they're reimbursing families through their wellness programs up to $1,500 for doula services. So that's a really good reimbursement rate. I think the average for doulas in the state is around $1,200. I think it goes up to $2,500 if you're closer to New York City. So the